This podcast contains descriptions of alcohol and drug abuse, sexual assault, adult themes, violence, and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. On June 3rd, 2011, a young woman named Lauren Spear disappeared after a night out with friends at Indiana University, never to be seen again. As a fellow IU student who grew up with similar circumstances, her story has haunted me. There were so many nights my friends and I could have ended up like her. This is the story about what happened that fateful night at a historic university and a quaint Midwest town with a hidden dark side. This is Finding Lauren. As we mark the 10th anniversary of Lauren Spear's disappearance, it seems we are just as confused today about what happened in the early hours of the morning of June 3rd as we were in 2011. For a long time, rumors circulated about that night and still do. I spent the whole summer leading up to attending IU hearing stories about what could have happened to her. It was unsettling. Everyone knew someone that claimed to know something. When I arrived at school, there were even more theories on what happened and where she might be. People swore that it was drug-related or 100% someone took her. Everyone was obsessed. This huge tragedy occurred so close to home without any resolution. It was apparent that no matter who you spoke to, all of the theories boiled down to either something happened with the boys that night or on her way home, she was the perfect target for a predator in her intoxicated state, a hard pill to swallow. There are a lot of key players in this story, but the theory of the boys being involved is one of the reasons this case has garnered so much interest. It's suspicious to think that the boys in question, Corey Rossman, Jay Rosenbaum, Jesse Wolf, and Mike Beth, might know more than they have let on or are covering something up. Why would that be? Because they were partying with her and doing drugs or gave her drugs? If something happened to her accidentally, it seems like a lot of work that anyone would be able to hold a secret like this for so long, unless there was more to the story. I can't tell you what happened, but what I can tell you is that part of what makes it so difficult to uncover the truth is how incestuous all of the relationships are. It all stems from the fact that everyone was friends with each other and how all of Lauren's girlfriends dated boys in this one fraternity, apes. Indiana University was undoubtedly famous for its eccentric party scene, with the nucleus being the Greek community. Being a part of Greek life at any school is a defining decision for a student, but at a school the size of IU, it's like being a part of an exclusive society with a built-in friend group and a social calendar full of themed parties and events. Currently, IU has around 40 frats and sororities, and each house has around 200 members. And there were tiers within the Greek system. The frats with the coolest guys and the best parties always wanted to hang out with the sororities with the hottest girls. They'd pretend like GPA mattered because that was a national requirement, but let's be real, it wasn't that hard to maintain the minimum of a 2.8 average at IU to be in one of these houses. Everyone would proudly sport their Greek letters around campus on sweatshirts or tote bags. And in classes, it's like these people would naturally gravitate towards each other. They were the cool kids. Lauren Spearer and her friends were not members of a sorority. They were part of a collective group of East Coast students known as GDIs, or Goddamn Independents. Independent because they were not members of any house chapter. Some might argue to not be a part of Greek life at IU would be social suicide, but for a girl, it wasn't that bad. For the most part, you could attend whatever parties you want, as ladies were always welcome, and you had the freedom to live outside of the frats and sororities, which was its own mess with very little privacy or personal space. For guys, it was almost imperative you join a house, as they weren't as readily welcome to parties or events without being associated with a particular community. For that reason, the GDI guys were always trying hard to throw down on wild pre-games or bottle service at sports to keep themselves entertained. The party scene was competitive. Before Lauren's disappearance, the GDI community was thriving. But after, you needed some form of social structure because everything was in disarray. When I transferred to Indiana for my sophomore year, I was already a national member of Alpha Phi from my previous school. Having been told by my friends that you don't need to go Greek, I did the GDI thing that year, but not being 21 combined with the intense new guidelines the school implemented as a result of Lauren's disappearance made me feel out of place, especially with the shadow of tragedy lurking over the GDI community. I felt compelled to align myself with the Indiana University chapter of Alpha Phi, which I eventually did the following year, a house that was the complete opposite of the scene I had run in. It was refreshing. There was some overlap with the GDI and Greek communities, especially if you were from a major city. Plus, a lot of these kids met their freshman year before things got divided by Greek and non-Greek. As far as Lauren's scene was concerned, there were only a few houses you would join if you were a guy: ZBT, ATO, Sammy, and the off-campus infamous Apes. These houses were primarily made up of Jewish, tri-state areas with a sprinkle of Chicago suburbs and Los Angeles. It is true when they say birds of a feather flock together. These boys liked to have a good time. Differently from the other houses around campus, they had more edge. They listened to different music and dressed differently. While a lot of the frat guys sported polos and khakis with Docksiders, these guys wore expensive sneakers and nice watches and jeans. When I eventually started meeting the other frats with Alpha Phi, I would still prefer partying with this group, and so did my sorority sisters. The fraternities in general all had reputations that excelled at drinking and drug use, but it was Apes in particular that was known throughout campus as the drug frat. They were formerly the AE Pi chapter, but were getting so messed up all the time, they got kicked off campus, and some of the members turned to run an illegal off-campus fraternity that they called Apes. Illegal because it was not according to school code to operate official clubs with members and hazing without affiliation and permission from the university. But Apes wasn't the only frat scrutinized. According to the Daily News in 2016, IU instituted a new policy that would allow IU police to raid public areas and private rooms of fraternity and sorority houses to weed out illegal drinking and drug use. If a Greek house did not sign the contract agreeing to the new policy, they would lose their university affiliation and would be barred from participating in campus activities. The policy was put in place in response to high-profile scrutiny of partying and alleged sexual misconduct. It was the most drastic measure the university has taken in its effort to rein in rampant partying in the unruly Greek system. Since 2016, 46 IU house chapters have faced disciplinary action due to violation of drugs, drinking, or sexual assault. Many of them ultimately lost their university affiliation, which is why now there are less houses. Besides all of that, the Apes parties were fun and got rowdy. The main difference between them and the other frats was that they had no official massive house, just a bunch of smaller off-campus townhouses. I remember at one house, Blue House, the wooden floor caved in the main party room from herds of drunk students jumping. Even though Apes had this frowned-upon reputation for being the drug frat, they still had no problem getting people to party with them. Many sororities were banned from having any sort of on-the-books events considering their reputation and being off-campus. I know the Alpha Phi chapter had to make announcements at our Sunday night meetings to remind us that if more than five girls were caught at Apes, they'd be put on social probation. This ban existed prior to Lauren's disappearance, but intensified after, considering the persons of interest had relationships with the frat. But that didn't prevent girls from going there on their own or bringing a few friends.
And Apes had a little more free range because they weren't a campus fraternity. They had a few different houses where they would throw parties and...
Couldn't get in trouble
for having so many people, and they would do fun theme parties, and it was always a place to go. I had a ton of friends who were in Apes.
Apes truly lived up to their name in that they were animals. Their basement parties were sweaty and loud, filled with people slurring and falling on each other. Multicolored strobe lights and smoke machines made everyone seem more attractive. As I mentioned, if you were looking for any sort of substance, it could be found on campus no matter if you were Greek or not. You just might have to search a little harder. As for apes, almost every single one of their members were engaging in drugs and drinking, as that was its main draw. Many were even dealing the drugs. When they looked to rush new members, they used their infamous party scene as an allure.
We would go to like Apes and ZBT, and they would do like jungle juice. They would put Xanax in their like punch and drinks. The boys, a lot of our guy friends, I remember like they had so much Xanax on them at all times, like bars, like those sticks on them at all times. And like a few of them had to leave school because of like Xanax.
Jesse Wolf, Lauren's boyfriend of 3 years at the time, was a member of Apes. He is a New York kid from Port Washington, a suburb in Long Island. He lived in a house just north of campus. He was studying business at IU and graduated with a certificate from the Kelly School along with a BS in Business Administration and Management. A rigorous major, and it's a top-tier business school. Jesse and Lauren met at Camp Towanda, the sleepaway camp they both attended in Pennsylvania. Jesse is reported to have stayed in that night to watch basketball. Jesse's father, Alan Wolf, said that he and his son were texting that night, and Jesse also indicated that he and Lauren were texting back and forth. Lauren had told him that she was at home and going to sleep, which we know is not true. Lauren went out. Jesse said he passed out at 2:30 a.m. and the next day is confirmed to have reported Lauren missing. It's no surprise that Jesse has faced major scrutiny since Lauren's disappearance. He was her boyfriend. Usually the people closest to someone missing are always the first to be considered. One of the main reasons people questioned his innocence is because Lauren went out without him after allegedly telling him she was home and how that was perceived. It was rumored that he freaked out and maybe did something in a jealous rage and then reported her missing the next day. I think back to some of my friends' college relationships and if it would have been normal to go out with a group of guys and get that drunk while your boyfriend's at home. To some degree, yes, if the entire crew was friends and the boyfriend trusted them. But for her to spend her night with Corey Rossman, to me, it sounds like they were fighting or just something wasn't right. And maybe it wasn't. Maybe she was moving on or just trying to have fun. After all, Jesse was graduating and 2 years older than Lauren. Maybe things were fizzling out. Maybe she was purposely trying to make him jealous. I've been there. A lot of people have brought this up as a potential motive on his part. Would Jesse be at all matter jealous that Lauren was going out with a bunch of guys? Would it be at all possible that Zach Oakes, who had gotten into a fight with Corey Rossman at Smallwood, reached out to him and let him know that she was with Corey? The two did know each other. Lauren was beautiful and vibrant and fun. Who wouldn't be interested? Calling a spade here, a lot of guys really don't care if a girl has a boyfriend. If they want to go after her, they will. To add to his suspicion, it has been said he only searched for his missing girlfriend for 2 days before returning home to New York. According to the Daily Beast by Robert and Charlene Spears' account, Jesse had a healthy relationship with their daughter. He spent many nights at our house, and Lauren spent many nights at his house. They were very close, Robert Spears said. He is still close to us, and I feel bad that he's suffering, Charlene Spears added. That quote was taken from an interview given in September 2011, just a few months after Lauren went missing. The Spears sentiment on Jesse has since changed. There has been a lot of back and forth between the families and even some conflicting statements made by Jesse. Although the Spears have indicated they believe Jesse has told them everything he can, their communication has been stonewalled. As I keep saying, everyone has their guard up. USA Today reported that shortly after Lauren disappeared, Alan Wolf joined his son in Bloomington. He said he had to take his son to Corey Rossman's apartment. I knocked on the door and asked for Corey, Alan Wolf recalled. I confronted the kid. I just looked into his eyes. I saw fear. Alan Wolf said his son has cooperated fully with the police and the Spearers, discussing the case with the parents without a lawyer present. He also met with their private investigators. In 2013, 2 years after Lauren went missing, Jesse took a privately administered polygraph test from a retired FBI agent that he passed. His family wanted to be 100% sure of his innocence. But this is another thing that strikes people as odd. Although he has cooperated on the bare minimum, why does it take 2 years to agree to take a polygraph if you have nothing to hide? And why refuse to take one from the Bloomington police? Jesse's mother, Nadine Wolf, had the same sentiment we all did when it came to the Bloomington police. She didn't trust them. Nadine told USA Today, "I don't think they're very adept at anything except for giving kids drinking tickets." As believable as it may be that the Bloomington police are not the most skilled, it seems a little too convenient. Nadine Wolf went on further saying, "This poor little girl is not with us today because of her drug abuse. If Jesse was guilty of anything, he was guilty of taking care of Lauren, who had some serious drug issues. She would abuse to the point where she would black out. Jesse always threatened to call and tell her parents, and she said, 'If you do, I'll break up with you.' My son took care of her for 2 years while she was in college. The one night she went out without him and did what she did, unfortunately, cost her her life." Nadine Wolf also went on to say that Lauren was asked to leave the sleepaway camp the two attended due to drug use, which hasn't been confirmed. Although Jesse's parents might have wanted to protect their son from the media and harassment he had been receiving since Lauren's disappearance, this brash statement felt very aggressive and excessive. It makes me feel like they're deflecting, especially for parents who knew Lauren. The fact that Nadine Wolf refers to Lauren in the past tense shows me a lack of empathy. However, to her credit, the police did report that after her disappearance, a small amount of cocaine was found in her apartment. Here is Dr. Robin Stern again.
Well, it sounds like it sounds like this mom was like ferociously protecting her child by making sure that everybody knew that it was not his fault at all. And in fact, if she had listened to him, then she might be alive today. So putting all the blame on her and making sure that nobody's looking at Jesse to have any responsibility. I mean, clearly he obviously is carrying something, but what he's carrying, who knows? Like, he could just be carrying grief, or he could be carrying so much anxiety that because he knows something that he isn't sharing, or like, we can speculate, but we don't know.
Jay Rosenbaum also told investigators that Lauren had snorted cocaine and crushed up Klonopin tablets that evening. But even when I mentioned this type of behavior to my parents, their response was, "And? This is just what kids do at college. They experiment. It doesn't change the fact that there is still no closure and could be a chance that the boys know more than they are admitting." But maybe the Wolves were genuinely tired of having to defend their son and tell the same story over and over that he had no idea what happened to her. That's gotta be rough for him. Even though Jesse ultimately took a polygraph, the Spearers have not been satisfied and continued to urge him, as well as the other boys in question, to succumb to a police-administered test. The problem with the theory of Jesse is that there would have been no surveillance cameras on the route to where he lived, to the 5 North townhomes. If he went to Smallwood, he would have been captured on surveillance. He wasn't. So was he actually at home? How can we prove this? Lauren spent most of her night on June 3rd with a new acquaintance, Corey Rossman. Corey is from the suburbs of Boston and is reported to have only met Lauren a few days prior at the Indianapolis 500, but it had been rumored he made it known to his friends that he was into her. Two of Lauren's closest friends gave an interview with Fox after her disappearance to raise awareness. When asked if they knew who Corey was, they said they had no idea and had never heard of him. Corey was also studying at the Kelley School and graduated with a degree in real estate and finance. So much of what we know from that night is speculative information. There are only 3 confirmed locations of Lauren on surveillance. The rest is all talk. What we do know for certain is that Corey was drinking heavily with Lauren. It began at Jay Rosenbaum's pregame, continued at Kilroy Sports Bar, where he bought Lauren even more drinks despite her being clearly intoxicated at that point. The two get involved in an altercation at Smallwood and finally return to his apartment at the 5 North Townhomes. Corey repeatedly claims to not be the last person with her. After Lauren disappeared, he hired Bloomington-based criminal defense attorney Carl Salzman, who gave the statement that Corey suffered short-term memory loss due to the punch he sustained at Smallwood. Many people speculate that this is an odd coincidence to not remember a thing. However, his roommate Mike Beth, who is represented by Ron Chapman, a criminal defense attorney in Bloomington, confirms that when Corey and Lauren returned to their apartment, Corey was in such bad condition, he vomited on his way to bed, where he remained for the rest of the night. Corey has a record of partying that has led to infractions in the past. That doesn't make him guilty of anything, because I know my friends have all had their issues with the Bloomington police and various authorities as well, but still. The night he entered Lauren's Smallwood apartment complex, the Daily Beast reported that he was violating a no trespass order, which states that he was indefinitely banned from the building. That means he must have done something pretty significant to get banned from a building that, as I've stated, is a free-for-all for partying and depravity. I can't stop thinking about why they were going back to Lauren's apartment, unless the accounts of him trying to hook up with her are true. And specifically, in regards to the fight between Corey and Zach Oakes, why wouldn't the two of them just still go to her apartment after? They were right there. None of it made sense. It's also hard to say what Corey's involvement could be here, considering all the boys in question confirmed that after Lauren and Corey arrived back at his apartment, she then went over to Jay Rosenbaum's, who admits to being the last person to see her. The most suspicious thing about Corey, aside from his motives with Lauren that night, is his behavior over the last few years. In 2013, Corey gave his first public interview since Lauren disappeared to Sean Cohen. Corey claimed that Lauren's parents were harassing him and the other victims of the evening. In reality, they were desperately looking for answers from the last people with their daughter, and I can only imagine my parents doing the same if this were me. Corey claims that he and Lauren's other friends were also victims due to negative media coverage they faced. He said, "It's inappropriate the way they're harassing people that are also victims in this case. We've done nothing wrong. If we'd done something wrong, we would have been arrested already. All they're doing is hurting my career." Corey went on to criticize the Spearers. "It's permanently changed all our lives. You should write an article about how the parents are harassing us. None of my friends have done anything wrong." He also seemed to distance himself from lawyer Carl Salzman's statement that he had no memory of his final moments with Spearer. "I never said that," Rossman said. "You're taking statements that were said by my lawyer. I never said I did or didn't." Corey Rossman has refused to speak to the Spearers directly or the private investigators. However, he has submitted to a DNA test and his apartment and car were searched. Based on the cringeworthy statements he gave to the Journal News and his contradicting statements about his memory that night, giving his DNA might be done strategically to make him look cooperative. As we know, Jay Rosenbaum is the self-proclaimed last person to see Lauren. Jay is from West Bloomfield, Michigan, an affluent suburb outside of Detroit. Ironically, Jay's family and Lauren's family have crossed paths before. For nearly two decades, Lauren's grandparents lived just yards from Jay Rosenbaum's grandparents on the same Rockland County, New York street. Jay has not strayed from his story that when Lauren got to his apartment, he tried to get her to sleep on his couch. However, he insists that around 4:30 a.m., he watched Lauren leave his apartment to head back towards Smallwood Plaza. On the corner of 11th and College was the last reported sighting of her. The security cameras along Lauren's return route did not capture any images of her walking home. Jay also had friends visiting from Michigan that weekend. At 4:15 a.m., Jay states that Lauren uses his phone to call David Roan, her companion from earlier in the night, because she couldn't locate her phone. He didn't answer. He had returned to Smallwood shortly after arriving at Jay's apartment with Lauren. This has been confirmed by security footage of him entering the building and remaining there until the next morning. What is interesting here is that David Roan, who is also represented by Ron Chapman, confirms a call came to his phone at 4:15, but does not go on record to state from who. However, David Roan took an FBI-administered polygraph, which indicated no deception. Why would he not confirm who made that call? This piece of information always struck me. Could that have been a panicked call actually made by Jay? Did something happen to Lauren at Jay's apartment and he freaked out and started calling his friends for help? Although he admits to being the last person to see her, is his story believable because all of the details can be lined up and confirmed until Lauren's walk home? After Lauren's disappearance, Jay hired defense attorney James Voiles. Voiles is best known for representing Mike Tyson, which is an indication of the types of access to high-powered representation these kids have. Those fees are not cheap. For 3 weeks after Lauren went missing, Jay was radio silent. Since then, he has taken a privately administered polygraph test that he passed and has spoken with Robert and Charlene Spearer, but with his lawyer present. Robert Spearer said in an interview that despite being able to speak with him, it was still very hard to get any useful information. Again, guards are up. This is a theme that continues to occur with the boys from that night. None of them would be fully cooperative or are doing the bare minimum. I have friends who have also grown up with Jay and say that he seems like a normal kid, not capable of hiding something like this if it happened on his watch. I know of girls who have gone on dates with him recently and say he seems totally normal. I've also heard the theory from people who know Jay that it is possible that he was trying to hook up with Lauren late that night and was rejected. The ego bruise alone could explain why he admits to being the last person to see her and why he was okay with her walking home so late and in such a state.
Yeah, so it's curious to me why he would even allow her to go. Not that it was his responsibility, but maybe it was. Would you allow a friend of yours? And so I could imagine, and again, this is complete speculation, but I could imagine that he has all kinds of guilt.
Then there's Mike Beth, who we know shared the apartment with Corey Rossman. Mike was studying telecommunications and graduated with a BA in telecom and a minor at, no surprise here, the Kelly School of Business. Out of all the boys with Lauren that night, Mike knew her the least. He has also continued to state that he was home working on papers that night, but we do know he was at Jay's pregame earlier in the evening. Mike is also submitted to a DNA test, and according to his lawyer, Ron Chapman, he has been as cooperative as needed. Here is a clip of Sean Cohen of the Journal News and private investigator Bo Deedle discussing possible theories.
I think if something happened to Lauren, say in that apartment, I would think they would have called an ambulance. That's my own feeling about that. But then again, you know, is it the big kept secret that three boys are keeping a big major secret? I don't know. That's why I say I leave everything open. I mean, as far as with the boyfriend, you know, he gave conflicting statements too. He's a suspect too. Everybody's a suspect, like I just said.
What were his conflicting statements?
About him being home and all that. Watching a basketball game.
He said he was home watching a basketball game, correct?
Yeah.
Not the case?
Put it this way. All his statements. And then everybody lawyers up. And, I mean, it was only... I didn't get to interview them in the beginning. That would have been an important thing to interview them then and get the sense of someone's lying or not or trying to cover something up. So I didn't have the affordability to interview them right after this happened, which I would have liked to have.
Well, what was he up to that morning? Because that was a big part of it, is he claimed that he was planning, there was a claim that he was planning to meet up with her that morning. It was unclear what time.
All I know is, again...
And she had lost her phone.
I don't trust people who want to help, but then all of a sudden subsequently retain attorneys to cover something or protect themselves. If you want to really find Lauren, you wouldn't have lawyers there. You'd be cooperating with the law enforcement people and with every aspect, every bit you can to try to help find Lauren. And when people get lawyers, it makes me suspect that they're trying to cover something up. Is it the drug usage? I don't know. I don't think so, because it's so prevalent there. Every kid's buying pot, cocaine, drinking pills. I mean, it's all over the place. So that really can't be the motive behind it. So, like I said, every one of them, I'm hoping again that even people watching this, that someone gets a conscience, someone who knows something, maybe one of the three boys, maybe the boyfriend, get a conscience, is living with this thing on their mind that they know what happened to Lauren, and step forward to clear their conscience. Hey, we had one in a murder case here in New York City. Guy killed somebody 12 years ago. Guy couldn't live with himself, and he came forward and said, look, I did this, it was an accident or whatever. And, you know, it could have certainly been an accident, too, that she passed.
If the boys were involved, the most likely scenario that was always rumored was that Lauren suffered an overdose of drugs and alcohol that was exacerbated by her long QT heart condition. There have been numerous studies shown on the effects of alcohol and other narcotics on the natural heart's rhythm. It's also no news that the combination of a drug like cocaine, which she allegedly used that night, known to increase the heart rate, combined with alcohol, a depressant that slows the heart rate, is already dangerous. The CDC has reported a shocking rise in cocaine-related overdoses in the last 15 years. And if Jay's remarks about her also taking Klonopin are true, this is very likely a reality of what happened. The question that remains, even in that scenario, is where would she be then? If she overdosed at their apartments and they got nervous and brought her somewhere, where is she? It just seems so sinister that after all this time, to hide what sounds like an accidental fatal overdose, unless there is more to the story. Even if the boys were responsible for giving her drugs, is that a strong enough reason to cover up something like this? For guys like this, with their whole lives at stake and so much to lose, it is very possible. The Spearers and others had questioned how her friends might have reacted if Lauren Spearer was in medical distress the night she was last seen. As of July 1st, 2012, the state of Indiana passed what is called the Lifeline Law, which grants immunity from certain charges, such as public intoxication and minor consumption, to those who call 911 when a friend has overconsumed drugs or alcohol. There was another, darker theory floating around that could explain a cover-up. It was speculated that the boys in question, as well as Jay's friends visiting, may have sexually assaulted Lauren, and that caused her death. They freaked out and got rid of her body. There were rumors they left her in the Ohio River or brought her back to Michigan. This was all talk, of course, but if you go down the Reddit holes or web sleuths, some people swear they heard that some of the friends packed up and left for Michigan first thing in the morning. There was also another theory about a cryptic deleted tweet from Jay Rosenbaum's best friend and now business partner David Bleznak about quote-unquote more people being around. And again, the fact that we have no footage of her ever leaving the Five North townhomes, is it possible she left, just not by foot? Knowing that all these rumors were floating around without any sort of confirmation was nerve-wracking. To think that if the boys were hiding something, how crazy it was for them to be walking around campus as if nothing happened. That feels like a lot of pressure. It also made me think about if they were innocent, how it must feel to be harassed by reporters day in and day out, having classmates stare and whisper when you walked into a seminar, and to suffer a trial by the media that no matter what, would forever alter your future. If Lauren did leave that night and the boys had no involvement, then this is surely devastating for them. I had my doubts, my skepticisms on the whole thing, but it was very taboo to talk about or to bring up with anyone because there were so many people close to the situation.
Depending on the person, guilt may show up in different ways. Feelings don't equal behavior, or behavior doesn't equal feelings. So just because somebody behaves in a certain way doesn't mean that they're feeling what you think they're feeling, because what you look like when you're experiencing guilt may be different than what I look like. When I'm angry, I cry. Maybe when you're angry, you scream. Maybe when you're sad, you slam the door. Maybe when I'm sad, I go and look for a tree and sit underneath it and just don't make any noise. So guilt is the same, that it may look different. But guilt about a secret means that you are living a double life, that there's a distance between what you're feeling on the inside and what you know on the inside and what you're showing or what you're talking about on the outside. And there's a term for that called emotion labor. So when you are feeling one thing on the inside and having to express something else on the outside, there's a cost, an emotion cost to you. And that leaves you tired, depleted, and sometimes dissociated from your own feelings because it's too hard to hold that for a long period of time. Think about it, like you're living a double life. When you're ruminating about something you're guilty about, like weighing it back and forth, well, is it really that bad? Do you feel so terrible about it? Can I do anything to make it up? No, I can never tell the secret. It just takes a lot of energy. And it makes it hard to think straight. It makes it hard to think clearly when you are caught up in that kind of activation about something you're guilty about. Long-term guilt can lead to self-punishment. It can lead to real lack of joy in your life if you're carrying that kind of guilt. If it's guilt that you, gee, I should have done more, I think you can work with that by saying, okay, I did this, I did that, maybe I could have done more, but I didn't, and I'm sorry, and that will never happen again. But if you're carrying a guilty secret that you know something about a disappearance that was never solved, I think it would be pretty hard to just go on frivolously with life, or even just without a lot of weight. It's very heavy. Carrying guilt is heavy.
If you Google Lauren's name, the first thing that pops up is the boys. So I can acknowledge Corey's frustration on his comment about it hurting his career. But Lauren's life is still more important than that. A lot of people questioned whether or not keeping a secret to that degree is possible. But again, to put myself in their shoes, with a future and a livelihood at stake, would you risk all of that? How far would you go to protect everything you have? If it truly was an accident, maybe they find peace in convincing themselves over time that not coming forward is justified because her excessive partying was inevitably dangerous. The following is retired, decorated New York Police Detective Bill Clark. He is best known for solving homicides and creating the hit TV show NYPD Blue based off his notebook. I sat down with him to pick his brain. He also really loves birds.
Well, I mean, obviously, if it's connected to the person, the case usually winds up getting solved. In the case where there's no relationship, you know, you've got a girl walking through the street staggering drunk, right? And she turns the corner into a block, and there's a person, sees it, snatches her, puts her in his car, takes her, has sex with her, and she's going to have you arrested. So it's tough to come up with it. You know, there's no relationship between the guy who snatched her and her, and there's no witnesses, you know. If he walks out of the bar with her and she's never seen again, that's a different story. You know what I mean? Then you look into every aspect of his life. Where does he live? Where's he got himself? Where does he go camping? Where does he go this? Where does he work? You know, and all those places are inspected, you know. And if you find her DNA in them, then you're looking hard at it. Where if she overdosed on drugs and they hit her, it would get to them because they
would crack.
Yeah, because they didn't kill her.
Yeah.
And she overdosed on drugs and, you know, they're drinking one night and it gets to them. But how the hell would I feel if that was my daughter or my wife, you know? And
it comes out.
Yeah.
To be a girl of similar stature and a similar friend circle at this time was an experience like no other. You wanted to go out and have fun, but then a little voice would pop into your head and remind you not to get too drunk or watch for your surroundings. A cautionary tale, yes, but it was deeply conflicting. You wanted to convince yourself that it was all good and something like this would never happen to you and that you could trust the guys around you, but nobody knew anything. A lot of the guys I knew and were friends with at school were also dealing drugs, but in the most innocent way, if that's even a thing. Not the scary, tattooed Miami Vice type that we are so often led to think of, but more like a Mr. Rogers friendly neighborhood dealer. They were all kids who enjoyed smoking weed or doing cocaine that mostly were just looking for an inexpensive way to support their habit. Where they came from, I never knew. I heard rumors the drug ring extends far wider than any of us realized, and we didn't question it too hard. We were just happy to have it. Another detail that makes the theory of the boys seem plausible, especially if it involves sexual assault, is knowing how often other occurrences in which foul play was happening on campus. At least the ones that were reported anyway. As mentioned, we spent a ton of time at ZBT, and those were some of my best friends. At the beginning of my junior year, a year after Lauren had been missing, ZBT got kicked out of their house due to several sexual assault claims in which members had been found responsible. In the aftermath of the fraternity's loss of housing, rumors circulated about the future of the fraternity and of more possible rapes, and even the presence of a quote-unquote rape room within the fraternity's former house. ZBT's disciplinary problems began in April 2010, when a woman was hospitalized after over-consuming alcohol at a fraternity function. They received citations for the uncontrolled distribution of hard liquor. But in September of 2011, allegations of sexual assault surfaced. According to IU Police Department records, a forcible sex offense was reported at ZBT's house, but the case did not end in arrest. No charges were filed. I always wondered if it was because there wasn't compelling evidence or if similarly, these would be the types of guys to immediately lawyer up and make it difficult to find a resolution. In 2015, two other IU fraternities shuttered for hazing, drug, and alcohol violations. One of the frats, ATO, closed after a shocking video surfaced showing a member being forced to perform oral sex on an exotic dancer as dozens of shirtless brothers cheered him on. Indiana University and the local chapter of Delta Tau Delta are currently the targets of a Title IX lawsuit filed by a woman who claims to be the second rape victim of one of the frat's members. She is accusing the school and the fraternity of deliberate indifference to excessive partying and sexual violence. The sexual assault numbers at IU have continued to rise. The Daily News reported that a 2015 campus climate survey suggested that alcohol and drug abuse were entwined with sexual misconduct at IU. 29% of women and nearly 8% of men reported experiencing some form of non-consensual sexual touching while at IU. Alcohol and drug use by one or both parties was a factor between 60 and 83% of the incidents of sexual misconduct. The school had its highest number of reported sexual assaults in the 2018-2019 academic year. There were 287 reports of sexual misconduct made against students, and those were the only ones that were reported. It's a known thing that a majority of sexual assaults go unreported for a variety of reasons. This demonstrates a clear increase in partying as well as the prevalence of rape culture. And again, I never felt like the kids I hung out with could be capable of something like this, and I also never thought I'd find myself in a position where this was happening to me. But I'm sure Lauren felt the same. You always think it can never happen to you.
In the beginning of the school year, everyone was more like guarded and cautious. But then once we just kind of got back into our routine, we would still get just as drunk. The boys used to say that they would watch us get home and make sure that we all got home safely and not let us walk home alone. But at the end of the day, we would all be too wasted and fucked up to be able to like keep track of each other. And I walked home alone all the time, but then there were girls who were definitely more cautious.
When you think about what the difference is between college students, for example, and high school students, not only is it your first time alone, perhaps, for most people, but it's also the first time because you're alone that you have to rely on skills that we call the skills of emotional intelligence that are aside from your cognitive intelligence alone, you know, your academic intelligence, or emotional intelligence is also cognitive. But the skills that you need to navigate your everyday life, like you're saying, well, I know my limits. So that's the first skill, being able to know yourself, to be aware of yourself, to recognize when you are like not okay. You know, if you don't have that skill, bad things can happen. And when you're coping with medication and liquor on top of not being able to know yourself, you certainly can't make appropriate decisions. If you don't have the skills to help you manage your emotions, you're going to be in trouble. And so rich kids have that problem just as much as poor kids. They have different kinds of stressors, for sure. They have different kinds of worries. And I'm not talking about people who are billionaires versus people who are living in homeless shelters. I'm just talking about the average continuum of kids who have a lot and kids who don't. And the public school kids and the private school kids have a lot of different issues, but they all need the skills of emotional intelligence to know themselves and to cope with difficult moments.
Robert and Charlene Spear have gone on the records many times to say that they don't think it was random or that she left the Five North townhomes that night. They believe someone close to her knows something. Let's say that it's true, that something did happen to her, and together they made a pact of silence. After all these years and looking to help themselves, wouldn't someone crack? Statistically speaking, yes, someone would. We just don't know. As I go through pages and pages and searches of interviews with Lauren's family, begging and pleading for more information from the boys in question, my heart fully breaks. It makes no sense why there wouldn't be more help from them. Something isn't right. The following audio is taken from an interview that Robert and Charlene Spear gave to the Journal News.
Lori Rossman has been completely shut down, non-communicative, won't talk to us. Mike Beth was interviewed by our private investigators, and Jay Rosenbaum did meet with us in a controlled setting at his attorney's office. So we did have the opportunity to talk to Jay. But Corey, you know, individually has been completely shut down and non-communicative. I just don't understand as a parent how these boys and their families and their parents have allowed this to go this far without doing everything they could possibly do. They maintain that they have. I don't see it. Their behavior was just not consistent with a group of people who had nothing to hide and wanted to help to the extent that they could possibly help. They maintain that they did, but their behavior indicates to the contrary.
But there is another player in the mix, and that is the Bloomington Police Department and their pattern of mishandling cases involving missing persons or suspicious deaths. In the immediate weeks following the searches for Lauren, Lieutenant Bill Parker gave many statements in press conferences where little to no information of value was shared. This is something that will continue to confuse the family and followers of the case like myself when it is clear just how many tips have been generated. The media in attendance at these early press conferences showed up hoping for new information or details to share with the public, which consistently revealed vague anecdotal descriptions and updates. Does that sound like great police work? In 2015, during the state integrity investigation, meant to provide a comprehensive study of state government, accountability, and transparency, Indiana scored a D-. A D-. The objective was to assess different systems in place to deter corruption in various branches of state government. Indiana received a grade of an F in the categories of judicial accountability, state civil service management, ethics enforcement agencies, and public access to information. Although this investigation refers to Indiana as a whole, it demonstrates a direct correlation to the Spearer investigation. It also leads people to question the motives of the police. Was there the potential that someone with money and influence was bribing the department to keep things quiet? That concept seemed more and more likely as time went on, especially based on the access and power some of these key players and their families have. I'm not even saying that it is the police necessarily covering things up, but it is very possible that some parents are using their influence. What would it cost to keep things quiet?
In the case for like a small town police department, what motivates them? Is it the same thing that would motivate New York police department, just wanting to solve the case? Or do you think, you know, there are other factors that might motivate people's...
I would like to think, and I certainly, my experience was that if you're a homicide detective or you're a detective, your job is to solve that case. And you know, you walk in, I've walked into a room where there's a woman laying face down on a bed, shot and killed, and a four-year-old and a three-year-old laying next to her, shot and killed. Now, you don't think I want to solve that fucking case? You know what I mean? And so it's a challenge. You know, you take, it's personal. I mean, but as a detective, you're not, I can't imagine anybody who doesn't want to solve the case. Now, it does become a question of ability, but that's why, like, as a homicide detective, I would go to help with the detective in the squad, who's not a homicide detective, to work on that case, you know, and help them as best I could.
The case of Lauren Spear's disappearance is what is known in the world of prosecution as a heater case, which is one that attracts a lot of media attention. Usually, the crime has unsolved or unanswered motives surrounding the victim or perpetrators. So you'd think that in a case like this, the police department and the lead investigators on the case would want to do their absolute best to solve it, especially a young missing girl from a wealthy family from New York, and one that might bring some negative attention to Indiana University.
Yeah, under the circumstances, they may, you know, there's always the question of, you know, my uncle was a chief of detectives or something like that. But when all is said and done, the people in that business want the case to be solved. You'd have to be a pretty big of an asshole to let your feelings about somebody interfere with solving the case. Because when all is said and done, that's what's important. I hate to say this because, you know, it's just basic common sense. But, you know, if you're in a police department and you have a school or university, you want to maintain a relationship with them because that's a big part of shit that goes on, you know, between drug use and fighting and arguing and all the other shit that goes on in the school, you know. I mean, you want to keep that relationship going, you know. Now, I don't know how many people are even on that police department. Do you?
He's like 150.
Oh, so that's a good-sized department. So you don't have 150 assholes. You got to have some people that, you know, get their brains and get, you know.
It always seemed to me that the Bloomington police was just not very fond of out-of-state students. How they waited on State Road 37, ready to write a speeding ticket to anyone with a New York license plate going just slightly above the speed limit, this was all too common. It also seemed like they were focused on all the wrong things, relentlessly handing out drinking tickets while there was still violence and strange behavior occurring on campus. It was almost like that was what they were most equipped for. Maybe this was a factor in the police's unwillingness to share information. Maybe they were just tired of dealing with spoiled, out-of-state students and their nonsense. From everything I have heard about Lauren, although she fell into the category of a privileged out-of-state student, there was nothing but positivity and praise for who she was. She was popular at school with a huge group of friends from the East Coast. People described her as being infectious and lighting up a room. She is the type of girl you want to be around. According to the Indianapolis Monthly, after the disappearance, Charlene Spear got a letter from the mother of a girl Lauren grew up with, who also attended IU. She confessed that her daughter had been jealous of the more popular Lauren until, when the daughter was struggling, Lauren reached out and helped her. She had a huge heart, Charlene said. She would do anything for anyone. The sentiment was the same for those who loved her. There was no doubt that this was a kind-hearted girl with a large capacity for love. If one thing had been any different the night of June 3rd, it's safe to say that Lauren would still be here today. Lauren was a fashion textiles major with internships lined up at Anthropology. Maybe she'd fulfill her dreams and become a designer. Maybe she would be getting ready to start a family of her own. There has been a lot of victim blaming in this case, but when I think about Lauren and her experiences, I think about myself. I know she inherently was a good person, just out having fun. Any extracurriculars that she may have been involved with while being young and away at college don't define her and certainly do not justify what happened to her. She was a college kid living the college experience. Lauren Spearer had so much potential. On the next episode of Finding Lauren.
Anytime there's more than one person involved, the chances of getting ratted out are greater.
And so we try to help organize those searches, and we participated. Lots of faculty and staff and students participated in those searches, just doing anything that we could to try to find Lauren.
Putting up posters was another thing. Like, sometimes we wouldn't be searching. Sometimes I would just literally be putting posters on every telephone pole and everything else, all over. We print so many posters.
I think seeing the people change was the craziest.
Lauren Spearer's case is still an open investigation. Anyone with information regarding her disappearance, please reach out to Bo Deedle and Associates. For updates from her family, follow the official Lauren Spearer updates page on Facebook. Finding Lauren is hosted and produced by me, Kira Breslin, edited by J. Cody Spellman. Engineering and original music by Monty Weber. Logo design by Josh Stauffer. Special thanks to USA Today Networks for use of media. For links to sources, clips, and more information, you can follow at Finding Lauren Podcast on Instagram.